From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk about the intersection of design and technology with a MIAD graduate who's now the lead UX or user interface designer for Google.
Then one of the people behind a Delafield company that specializes in virtual reality says his first project was a tough one to top.
The trouble with it is when you go down on Titanic when you're 25 or 26, then what do you do next, right? So I've been sort of running my life trying to figure that out.
And Wisconsin writer Marsha Bjornerud's new book makes the case for understanding geologic time as a way to help save the world.
My call for thinking like a geologist is really not that radical. I'm asking for us to learn to be able to think on decadal, maybe century kinds of timescales. And those are the ones that are going to be relevant for climate change that's looming over us.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. The first two segments on our show today are about the intersection of people and technology. That's something that's a focus at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, which boasts an innovation center that works with emerging technologies like VR and AI.
When Michael Delgadio graduated from MIAD in 2001, that sort of work either didn't exist or it was in its infancy. Delgadio rode the technology wave and is now the UX or user interface design lead at Google. He was back at his alma mater this week to give a lecture at the MIAD Creativity Series, and he joined us in the studio. Michael Delgadio, welcome to the show. Michael Delgadio, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So if you and I were sitting on a plane together and I asked you, what do you do? What would you tell me? How would you describe what it is you do?
I think that in the most relatable way, I generally tell people that I make technology easy to use.
Okay. So talk a little bit more about that. Making a cell phone easier to use, making what easier to use?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a number of technology products in our lives. And as you know, technology has become more prolific, you know, throughout everyone's lives. And it's often the case that it's not immediate how we should use that as human beings. And so as engineers develop the technology, it can become kind of an abstract idea of what we're supposed to do with it, and it can become complicated. And so what I fundamentally do as a UX designer is make technology easy to use for everyone.
So in a way, you're an intermediary. You're trying to interpret what the engineers are doing to get the product to me, the consumer, so that I might have an idea of what I might do with it.
Yeah, and I would actually flip that around a little bit. I think that sometimes we are doing that, where we're trying to understand, you know, the intent of engineering. Other times, which is more likely the case, we are trying to understand what people are trying to achieve and how they perceive things. And we're trying to understand potential pain points in what they're trying to do. So that we can also build products based on those expectations and those understandings of how the world works.
But still, you're sort of in that nexus point,
exactly.
You know, where things are coming at you from both perspectives, and it's up to you to make it all somehow make sense.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that you can say that that's me. And I would also take that to the next level and say that as a UX designer, we often work on interfaces to technology. And I would say that that interface is actually that nexus point where it needs to come together to make it a relatable product.
Well, and relatable and usable for the average person who a lot of people might say, well, I have no idea what I would use that for. I can remember when I got my first Mac computer in the 80s, you know, thinking, well, I'll write papers on this.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea because it just didn't occur to me. Even though I was a big science fiction reader, mm-hmm. I had no idea what else it could be used for.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a failure of imagination on my part or just not really understanding.
And I would say that it's definitely not a failure on your part. I think that we shouldn't blame users for being unimaginative. I don't think that we should blame users for not understanding how to do something. I would say that that's actually a failure of the product. I think that also, you know, in that example, Computers were really basic back then. You know, they were made for writing papers. The internet was made for sharing documents at first. And we've come a long way, right? Computation has gotten a lot faster. It's become a lot cheaper. It's become a lot more embedded, you know, into our lives. It's in our pockets. It's in our cars. It's in our homes. And I think that as that's happened, just the number of things that you can do with it has really just, you know, transformed everything that we do, every aspect of our lives.
You graduated from MIAD almost 20 years ago now with a degree in its communications.
Communication design. Yep.
Yeah. And so in 2001, when you graduated, what were the kinds of problems you were looking to solve and how have they changed almost 20 years later?
That's a great question. So I'll take it even a step back further. I think that, you know, looking back at the last 20, 25 years of my career, I think that it really kind of started in high school when I began getting interested in the web. And so that was around, you know, 1995, 1996, and there was a program called Graduation Challenge. And what we had to do in high school was work with a mentor in the community to make something and then present that something back to our class. And that really, you know, set me off as being interested in the web. And so then arriving at MIAD, I thought, well, you know, I like making websites. That was kind of fun. And how could I really start to combine that with the idea of design? And this was pre-phone. This was pre-mobile, pre-wearable.
Phones were there, but they were like little basic Nokia handsets that
you could text on them. You could play Snake, you know. if you remember that
game. It looked DOS-based. Yeah.
But that was kind of where I started to bring those two ideas together, right? Thinking about the web and the internet and thinking about design and how I could apply those things. That was really where my mind was at. Back then, we were thinking about, we were in class, we were making, you know, CD-ROMs, interactive CD-ROMs. And it occurred to me on the plane ride out here, I was looking at Spotify, and Spotify just released version 80, right? I believe it was version 80. You know, if we were going to go back and do that with CDs, right? So like thinking about the distribution of floppies and the distribution of software and how you had to get disks and kind of load them into the computers. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
And, you know, things have really, really progressed significantly, you know, to say the least. But, you know, then it was really about creating interactivity that was a little bit more contained. Again, thinking about, you know, interactive CD-ROMs and interactive websites, but it wasn't, you know, to the scale in terms of, you know, what I'm doing now.
Where everything is sort of cloud-based now and everything is interconnected in a way where you don't have those discrete things like a CD.
Yeah, that's true. True.
It's all available elsewhere. It's on an app or it's on the cloud or something.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's largely true. I think that, you know, one of the things that we often talk about in design circles is like, where is the, you know, intelligence happening? And so I think that there is a desire to have some of it localized, but actually like be distributed, you know, on the cloud. So it's a little bit of a blend, you know.
Design is such an interesting term to me because, you know, design can mean literally the design of this paper holder that's sitting here to the design of a brand new application that will do something that I can't even imagine yet and everything in between. And it's like design is a way that we interact with the world or try to make sense of the world.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely fair. I think that, you know, back to your comment earlier about design and myself being an intermediary in terms of, you know, playing a role in how people should expect to use things. Because there's codified, you know, signifiers that we interpret about how we expect something to act and behave. And whether that is a door or an app or a piece of consumer electronics, like all these things have signals to us as to what we can expect them to do, how they should act, and how we should interact with them.
Well, and that explains why people get so angry when things change in a new version of a program that they're used to, and they want, well, the printing icon is supposed to be here. It's not supposed to be over there, or I'm supposed to do something this way, and it's asking me to relearn that.
Yep, absolutely. We definitely do fall into, you know, patterns of behavior, and behavior change is really, really difficult. I know that various companies and software groups have gone through that challenge where, you know, sometimes the approach isn't so much that we're going to redesign something, you know, from the ground up, because people can get lost in that transition. But sometimes we think about incremental change and how we can kind of nudge that behavior in one way or another, because like you said, behavior change is really difficult. And once somebody learns how to do something, they expect that thing to continue to be there. And you can see that sometimes, you know, when you change your password, there's actually muscle memory. You go to type the old password because your fingers are used to doing it exactly that way.
So, and you're also somewhat of a psychologist as well. You have to be thinking about how people work.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm a psychologist, but I do think that we try to understand how people perceive things, and whether that's understanding the mental model of how something works. You know, for example, we often talk to people, right? And so we often talk to people about how they expect products to work or what they think something should do so that we can make them better. And, you know, people's understanding of how things work as we've gone to a more cloud-based computation model has really, you know, been impacted by how they perceived things like the iPod to listen to music. So, for example, as we've moved from something like the iPod to a connected speaker like Google Home, which is completely cloud-based, you don't have to download things to it, right? And so, you know, the mental model of, you know, there was this thing that I had to download my music to so I could listen to it, to a speaker that automatically does that magically for me, you know, on demand, are two different mental models, right? And so we try to understand, like, what is people's perception of how something should work so that we can, you know, again, make better products for them.
Right, and get them to use the products that are coming, because if people resist and say, no, I don't want that, I want to be able to download, I want my control, or whatever mm-hmm. it is that they're thinking that they have with the older way of doing things, mm-hmm. then, you know, you're having to negotiate that resistance too.
Yeah, it's true.
What are some of the things you're working on right now that excite you the most?
Yeah, so I work at Google currently. I'm a UX manager for the Android TV team. So within Android, there's a number of different product verticals. We work on everything from phones to cars to maybe Android Auto to televisions. And so I recently became the lead for the group. And I'm really excited about reimagining television, honestly. We have a number of existing products that we're working on improving, but I think that, you know, Google has a lot of interesting pieces, whether that's Google Assistant or Search, that we think can make a better offering in the living room for what Google can do on TV. And so that's really what excites me now, and that's one thing that I'm really passionate about figuring out over the next few years.
So if I'm a TV viewer and I'm using a Google product or an Android product, what kinds of changes can I expect, or what kinds of options can I expect as a TV viewer in the next few years?
Well, I think that, you know, as we've seen the introduction of the Google Assistant into different surfaces and into different products, I think TV's been a little bit, you know, behind. And so one of the things that our partners are really excited about is bringing the Google Assistant into the television. And so, you know, I think the most immediate gain from that is being able to just voice search. So just say, I want to watch X thing, and it'll immediately bring it to you. However, I think that there's a lot more opportunity, right? And so if we look at how the assistant works on a connected speaker, it can do a lot more than that, right? It can answer things for you. It can answer questions for you. It can provide information for you. It can give you proactive pieces of information about your commute times. And so there's things like that that I don't think have been solved in the living room. And so I'm excited about trying to understand, like, those aspects of what Google can do for consumers in that space.
Going back to the science fiction idea, do you envision a time in the relatively near future where the entire house is basically interactive and wired? Or maybe wired is the wrong word. I'm thinking cloud, or I'm thinking, you know, where, you know, you can basically say, boil the water and do this, and the house kind of interacts with you?
That's a really interesting question. I think that there are aspects of automation that are highly beneficial. I think that right now we are in a place where I would call it transitional, where there are a lot of competing products and protocols that don't necessarily work together. I think that we'll look back on this time and see how kind of messy it is. the metaphor that I like to use is, I know that we were talking about computers in the 80s before, but before we had USB, it was really difficult to plug different things into your computer, and you had to download drivers, and you couldn't just plug in a microphone and have it work. And then USB came along, and there was a common protocol for plugging things into this device that made a lot of those product experiences a lot easier. And I really hope that we kind of get past this and that we have a more plug-and-play kind of model for the home, so that if you wanted to do those things, you could. But I think that the part of me that kind of worries a little bit is that there's a lot of tactile experiences. For example, a light switch, right? Like, there's something very kind of fundamental about just flicking it and having it go on. That's a physical experience. Once that gets removed with automation and and using your voice, it becomes a little bit trickier to understand, but there's also benefits. Like, I can be playing with my son on the floor and just, ask to turn on a song without having to get up. And so it's a fine balance. I'd like to think that, the future won't be kind of Jetsons level automation, but we'll probably find some, happy medium where we are offered the efficiencies and kind of the things that we want to do that are easier to do, and that'll make our lives better, but we won't kind of go full in on having everything being automated and kind of preemptively there for us. So, for example, I don't think that I would want the water to boil for me before I woke up, I think that I want to maintain control, and I think that users are going to want to maintain control as we move into that future.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that the idea that you have some say over your environment and what's happening in it.
Yeah.
Well, Michael Delgadio, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. Next time you're back in town, please stop by. We'll have another conversation.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for having me.
Michael Delgadio is the UX or User Experience Design Lead for Google. The 2001 MIAD graduate was back at his alma mater this week to work with students and give a lecture as part of the MIAD Creativity Series. You'll find a link to more about his work at WUWM.com.
Coming up next on the program, we'll meet another Wisconsin native who's pushing the VR frontiers and allowing the rest of us to go virtually where few have gone before. That's coming up on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Back with more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you have ever been to Delafield, you know the downtown area has a quintessential, cute, small-town feel to it. There are coffee shops, restaurants, craft shops, and all of them not far from a picturesque lake. But if you were to walk down the sidewalk, you'd have no idea that inside an unassuming office building is a sprawling warren of offices and conference rooms in which some cutting-edge work is being done.
They are the offices of Virtual Wonders, a company that is using augmented and virtual reality to transform the way we can experience historic and natural wonders around the world. At the heart of it is Wisconsin native Corey Jaskulski, the chief technology officer at Virtual Wonders. He was freshly back from an imaging trip to South Africa when we caught up with him at the company's headquarters. Thank you for having us here.
You bet. Glad to have you here.
So you have, and let me see if I have this right, degrees in physics, math, electrical engineering, and computer science. All of them from MIT or just...
No, the math and physics degrees were actually from University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, and the computer science, electrical engineering graduate degrees are from MIT.
All right. Well, so what were you thinking you were going to do when you started collecting these degrees?
Well, I really thought I was going to end up with a traditional engineering job. I really loved photography and videography, but I thought those would always be hobbies. And I would end up working at a Lockheed or Boeing or something doing regular engineering work. So I was really happy when I found a way to merge these two, engineering and photography, into a technology for exploration career.
Well, and so talk about how that happened. This work you're doing now has not really existed for all that long. How did things develop in your favor?
One of the first big projects I worked at on an engineering front was a subsea battery pack that could go to the bottoms of the ocean and handle that pressure without being damaged. And while we were working on that, James Cameron, the guy that made the movie Titanic, and maybe now more famously Avatar or Battle Angel, he asked if we could use these batteries in robots to explore and image the inside of Titanic.
How did he even know you were working on them?
Apparently, he heard from a Navy contact that was the main project lead on this, that we were working on these, and he really needed them for these underwater robots. So, you know, fast forward a couple of weeks later, and I'm in a three-man Russian sub, 12,500 feet deep, on the deck of Titanic, running these robots around inside to image the inside of Titanic in a way that hasn't been seen since it's been built. And that's when it really clicked for me. Like, I can use this imaging passion and the engineering that I'm really good at and merge these two together into a brand new career.
Can I ask, how old were you when that was going on?
I think I was 25 when that happened.
That's got to be kind of heady stuff for someone who was in a pretty early stage of his career.
It is, yeah. The trouble with it is when you go down on Titanic when you're 25 or 26, then what do you do next, right? So I've been sort of running my life trying to figure that out.
Well, so from that grew Hydro Technologies, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so after graduating from MIT, I started a company building technologies and sensors. A lot of it was for the U.S. military, for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, to test out some new technologies and new ideas. But a lot of that still was in sort of the more sensing area than imaging. So it wasn't really until my involvement with National Geographic that I became really heavy into this main career of technology for exploration.
Well, right. So when did the National Geographic work start?
I started with National Geographic, I think, in 2008. And I started on board at National Geographic headquarters in DC as the director of technology, and developed a lot of cool technologies there. One of them was the next generation Critter Cam, which is a camera system that we could actually suction cup on the back of humpback whales or great white sharks, and, you know, get some really amazing footage, both to help the science to understand what these animals are doing when you can't see them, but also obviously for the National Geographic TV shows and the like.
Were you inventing that stuff or taking advantage of existing technologies and adapting it, or some of both?
A little bit of both. I mean, most of this field and most of engineering in general, I would say, is, you know, use what you can off the shelf, but there's never a perfect solution. I mean, unfortunately, Sony and Panasonic and Canon don't make, you know, whale cameras. So you got to do a bit of inventing in order to make that all work out.
But to some degree, you've created kind of the, you know, the, for lack of a better term, the GoPro of animal cameras.
That's right. That's actually exactly what it is. Something that's small and easy to use and researchers can use instead of just experts. And that's exactly what the Critter Cam was.
Well, and so talk about how that work with National Geographic, the sensing work that you were doing as Hydro Technologies, how did it evolve to what you're doing now with Virtual Wonders?
Yeah, as we did more and more of the sensing work, and it started to evolve into imaging work. So even a lot of the military stuff we were doing started to move from sensing of, say, sound and pressure and light and stuff like that, more into image-based sensing. And at the same time, you know, I became involved with National Geographic and started doing more strict imaging work on the photography and videography side. So over time, that sort of morphed into taking a look at where there's a need in the science and imaging community and where we can develop new technologies to sort of show the world in a different light. And it's evolved into, that's 100% of what I do these days.
Well, it's 100% of what you do these days, but the purpose for it, you're not doing it on behalf of the Navy, you're not doing it on behalf of DARPA, you're kind of doing it on behalf of all of us.
Right, yeah, that's exactly the cool part of what we do now, is that our mission at Virtual Wonders, the company that I co-founded, is to share and protect the world's special places. So we're out there working with the scientists to help image and understand these places in a way that has been hitherto impossible, but also to share that with everyone in the world, to make it as museum exhibits, make it as 360 videos on Facebook, make it as VR headset experiences that everyone in the world can experience, because these places in some cases are really hard to get to, like Church of the Nativity in the West Bank is not necessarily a safe place to go, or the Congo is not necessarily a safe place to go. And being able to share this with everyone so we can all appreciate them while they still exist are, I think, pretty awesome goal.
It is not always a safe place to go. How did you get used to going to these kinds of places?
Yeah, I'm not sure I ever did. I mean, still, you know, going to the Congo and working in places where you're one of the few people without a AK-47 slung over their shoulder is still a little intimidating. You know, working underwater with sharks without cages is still a little intimidating. I think I think the answer for me is that the work is important enough that it justifies the risk. You know, not being afraid at all isn't bravery. It's stupidity, right? So I think it's just gauge the risk and decide if the science and the sharing of this with people is worth it.
Do you have scrapes, narrow escapes, and that kind of thing?
Always, yeah. A lot of the scrapes and narrow escapes. One story that I like to tell, which is probably not actually one of the more crazy dangerous ones, but I was diving, doing 360-degree video when that was a new thing, with sharks, particularly with bull sharks. And bull sharks are, pretty scary animals. They're, I think, second in the list of fatal shark attacks right after great whites. And so I was laying on the bottom of the ocean floor, maybe 50 or 60 feet deep on scuba, with a camera that I built hanging off my back. And the people on the top of the ship were trying to attract the sharks in. So they were throwing fish guts and blood over the side of the boat. And it's raining down fish guts on me 60 feet below. And so the bull sharks are getting really agitated, as you might imagine. But one did something that I had no idea a shark could even do. It swam up right in front of my face, and it just stopped and hovered. And it's so close to me that I can't even see the shark. All I see is the teeth, right? So I'm looking into this thing's mouth, and I'm like, oh my God, what do I do here? And the only thing I could think to do is take a big breath and blow bubbles at the shark because I'm on scuba. So I do that. I take this huge breath, and I blow out, and the shark swims away. It was afraid of my bubbles. And I thought to myself, well, this is awesome. They're just fish. I got this. Same shark does another circle, comes back and lands right in front of my face. I'm looking at his teeth again. I'm like, well, I got this. I understand this. I take a big breath and I blow out all my bubbles. I blow out so many bubbles you can't see for a second. It just obscures my vision, and the bubble's clear and the shark is still hovering there. So on the second time, he got this down and was sure he knew how to handle the situation. But yeah, I mean, just stuff like that. That's being that close to an animal that could absolutely end you is an interesting experience.
And clearly the shark got bored and left at some point.
He got bored when the fish ran out. When the fish stopped raining down from the surface, he realized that there wasn't anything to be had here.
You're doing that, or you're thousands of feet underwater looking at the Titanic, or you're inside King Tut's tomb, or the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. How much do you allow yourself to let your jaw drop in wonder before you have to set out about the technical business of imaging these sites?
It's actually sort of never before I start the technical imaging, because I usually get there and I'm so nervous to get the job done and make it beautiful and make it perfect. And that it's usually about halfway through that, at least on every job, I look around at one point and think, how on earth did I get here? I mean, this is so amazing and beautiful. And yeah, it's but it never fails. Every single place we've ever been, whether it is inside of a church or inside of a cave or flying over the Congo, it's the world's an amazing place.
Well, and at some level, what you're doing is you're allowing the rest of us to access these places, partly because that means we don't have to go and disturb them, but partly because most of us couldn't get to to King Tut's tomb or the Titanic or whatever. But at the same time, you kind of have the best of both worlds. You're imaging them, but you're physically there as well. So you do become kind of an explorer in this way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we all consider ourselves explorers here, and we've been places that no one's ever been before. And one of the cool things about sharing this stuff is, it's not just like we're imaging the outside of, say, Chichen Itza or something like that. We're going inside of every tomb and inside of every building, with permissions from the Mexican government and the archaeologists, so that we can give them the science data, but we can also share it with the world in a way that you'll never see it as a tourist. It's sort of a behind-the-scenes pass to see it just the same way that we do.
How much of that work are you doing, or who's lobbying, say, the Mexican government to allow you to go to do this?
A lot of that's my co-founder, Mark Bauman. And the great thing is because we're adding to the science, we give all of our data sets at no cost to the governments and the local stakeholders. And then we actually give a fair bit of the revenue back to the local nonprofits so they can maintain and protect these physical places while we're sharing the digital ones. And because of that model, it's actually been really easy to be able to collaborate with the governments around the world in order to get this sort of stuff done.
What are the limitations at this point? Is it the technology with which you can do this work, or is it the technology that's available to, either distribute it or showcase it? There are not a ton of museums that necessarily have the kind of equipment yet that you're able to, that you would be able to produce material for.
That's exactly right. It's the display technology that lags. So when we capture these places, let's say we capture a church, we'll capture that in maybe 100 billion 3D points. And that's more than any computer system in the world can show. So, you know, we've got to take that and reduce it and make it smaller. And that's what our 3D art team does, makes it something that's displayable. But even then, in a lot of these venues like museums and location-based entertainment, they don't have the platforms to show them. So that's why we're working on as well different display technologies, whether it's augmented reality that doesn't need glasses, or it's dome-based projection, ways to share this at physical locations like that.
How do you see this work fitting in with the kind of Instagram culture that we have today, where, you know, it's sort of not enough to see a place, but people want to, you know, have a picture of themselves in front of a place?
That's a great question. So one of the things that we can do with this data, like we showed you on the VR headset downstairs, is we can put you in a headset and you can walk around a physical room, and to you it looks like you're walking around the Church of the Nativity or the grounds of Chichen Itza. So what we can also do is, using an external camera, we can capture people in that environment almost like a virtual selfie, but in the real 3D environment. So it's pretty cool.
Well, and the great irony to this, to some of it anyway, is that you, when you go and image a site, you're actually editing the tourists out of it.
Exactly. Yep. We're always editing tourists out. I mean, if you think about an experience you want to have walking through the grounds of Petra, Jordan, the ancient Nabataean site, you really don't want to do that with 40,000 other tourists. You want to be able to walk through the buildings and see them and not hear, you know, people hollering and trying to make echoes and stuff like that. So yeah, we edit out all the people, and in our experiences, you and the people you're with are the only ones in the whole site.
Can you develop like a virtual reality unpleasant bus ride out to these sites?
Totally. I think that one wouldn't be a great seller, but we could absolutely do that.
So why are we here in an unassuming building in Delafield and not at Nat Geo headquarters in DC or you know, with all due respect to Delafield, someplace flashier?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so a lot of our work is in LA and Washington, DC and, you know, places like that. But I lived in DC while working at Nat Geo and lived in Colorado while running Hydra Technologies. My whole family and my wife's family, she's the youngest of nine, are from the area. And even though we moved out one winter, to other states and decided we would never move back because these winters are horrible, you know, at some point the draw of the family is enough that you decide to move back home.
How much time do you spend in the field versus the amount of time that you're back here in Wisconsin?
It varies. In a busy month, you know, spend the whole month in the field, but I would say probably about half the time or so in the field and half the time here, which is sort of a nice balance. You know, you get to enjoy the Wisconsin summers, but in the winter, try to spend most of your time in the field.
Well, listen, Corey Jaskolski, it's amazing stuff, and I hope we get to talk again and kind of show some of this stuff off in an audio way.
Well, thanks. Looking forward to it.
Corey Jaskolski is the Chief Technology Officer at the Delafield-based Virtual Wonders. He'll also be the speaker at the latest Science on Tap lecture at the Milwaukee Public Museum next Thursday evening. You can find more information about that from a link at wuwm.com.
One more break, and then a Wisconsin writer makes the case for understanding geologic time as a way to help save the Earth. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Understanding the enormous timescales in our planet's long history can be difficult. In fact, it can be practically mind-boggling.
But Wisconsin writer Marcia Bjornerud hopes her new book makes that history accessible to more people and at the same time helps us grasp the magnitude of our effects on the planet.
Bjornerud talked with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz about the book, starting with the significance of its title, Timefulness.
So timefulness is a deliberate counterpoint to timelessness. We kind of have this idea that we like things to be unchanging forever and somehow hovering above us in a way that is eternal. But the fact is, everything is full of time, and the recognition of that can actually be something that helps us make peace with our own short time on the planet, but also understand our deep roots here as well. So geologists have this habit. We look out on the landscape and see the many different iterations that it records.
I'd love to start with that idea of looking out at the landscape, and one you share early in the book is a snow day in the 1970s.
Right. So I think anyone who's grown up in a snowy climate has had that wonderful experience of waking up to a bright white world and then learning that the normal mundane schedules have been suspended and all of a sudden the day is yours. So I start with that, and a deep memory that I have of looking at our old world atlas when people didn't use Google Maps all the time and happening upon a page that showed all the time zones around the world, which generally run longitudinally. But there were a couple of places on this map that said no official time, so areas that were colored gray. And one of those was a remote archipelago in Arctic Norway called Svalbard. And I was just fascinated by this idea of this remote place that somehow had been exempt from time, measurements of time. As it happened, I actually ended up doing my PhD research in geology in Svalbard, and many years later found that it was not this romantic idea where time was running free, but in fact, a political disagreement between the Norwegians and the Russians, whether to use Moscow time or Oslo time there. But in a sense, the place was kind of exempted from time in being a bit of the ice age that was still with us, at least in the early 1980s and 90s when I was working there. More recently, when I've gone back, I've sadly found that time has come back with a vengeance to that place, and the ice age has lost its grip, and in fact, the place is changing faster than almost anywhere else in the world. So I use that old memory of a snowy day in Wisconsin as a starting point for my journey as a geologist and my relationship with time, both as a person and as a scientist.
Was it a certain something that motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think it's a growing sense of frustration with leadership and a growing sense of desperation as a scientist who sees how quickly human changes are affecting the Earth system and trying to cast it in a maybe a new, fresh way, making a human argument for thinking scientifically about Earth processes. I think as geologists, ironically, we're partly to blame. For years and years, geology has been trying to inculcate people with the idea that the Earth is old and geologic processes are slow. And now we're trying to change the narrative to say, well, actually, the Earth can change really fast, and we're changing it. And I think part of the difficulty in getting people to take climate change seriously is that we've changed the narrative a little bit. Both of these things are actually true. The Earth is old, and in the main, geologic processes are slow. But on the other hand, sometimes things can change fast. And we are now, we as humans are now numerous enough that we are agents of the first order. So the book is an attempt to recast some things that maybe people have heard before in a more human framework and argue that a scientific understanding of the Earth is imperative for us as a species, but it's also something that can be a source of some kind of existential solace as individuals.
So, Marcia, give an example of that recasting.
Well, a good part of the book is just kind of exposing the rates of different processes. So I talk about, in Bob Dylan's song, Blowing in the Wind, Bob Dylan asks the question, how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Which is actually a rather profound geological question. And so in that chapter, I talk about rates of tectonic processes, of earthquakes, of erosion. And the point is that there are many overlapping rates. Again, some are underlying slow rates. The tectonic plates move at rates of inches per year, about as fast as our fingernails grow, so slowly, but not so slowly that it's beyond our perception. And then other times, of course, they lurch. They can move hundreds of feet in a fraction of a second in a large earthquake. So the Earth has many modes and tempos, some of which are so fast that we can't react. We think of the Earth as something that's kind of static, and we are the ones that are fast, but sometimes the roles are reversed, and we don't like it when the Earth does these sudden lurches. And the same goes for the climate. And sometimes climate change is really a slow process, but it can be accelerated at rates that become very uncomfortable for us.
So one of the elements, I mean, you pack a lot of information into really not very many pages. It's just exquisitely crafted, I think. One element is a simplified geologic timescale. It's amazing just to have these points of reference.
Yeah, and Wisconsin has a remarkable record of a big part of the geologic timescale. Of course, no one place, not even the Grand Canyon, has a record of all of geologic time. That the timescale has been put together over the last two centuries by thousands and thousands of geologists from all over the world, and little by little we've pieced together this global story of the whole planet. But I think often people don't realize that here in Wisconsin we have a remarkably long record of many parts of that long story, especially the old rocks in the northern third of Wisconsin record mountain belts that came and went, a great rifting event, sort of like what's going on in East Africa today, a hot spot interval where we would have been something like Yellowstone. So we have a remarkable record of a good chunk of Earth's long history in our backyards.
I am a person who appreciates landscapes and who places value on our resources. But you, as a scientist, a geologist, see landscapes differently than many of us.
I think that's true. And for me, it's something that it's like learning to read. Once you learn to read, you can't not read again. It's a habit of mind. It's a habit of seeing. An analogy that I sometimes use is that of palimpsest texts. This is a word that's used by medievalists, medieval scholars, to describe ancient parchments that were inked, written on with ink, but then because parchment was expensive and difficult to make, they were reused, so the ink was scraped off, and then they were inked over again with new writings. But always there'd be some vestige of the earlier writing remaining beneath the more recent writing. And I think that's a great metaphor for the way geologists see landscapes. We can look out and see what it looks like today, but we can also see vestiges of these earlier versions of the landscape. And of course, may become faint at some point, but you have this sense that time is still with us, that the place has this long backstory. Another way I sometimes describe geologic thinking is to say it's the etymology of the world. It explains how things came to be. I've always loved word origins that give us this kind of insight into how the vocabulary that we use today actually has these deep roots in the past. And I think geology is that for every place on the earth that we can look at.
There's the natural world and how we impact it, and then the regulations that our governments craft, presumably to safeguard those systems.
Right, to safeguard the systems, and I would argue ourselves. So the systems are robust. They've been around a long time. We can do damage to them. But in the end, nature will do what nature does. And especially with respect to the climate system, we think we're much more resilient than we really are. Earth has seen hotter times and it's seen colder times, and ecosystems have come and gone with those climate changes of the past. But humans get really upset with the smallest little perturbations. A hurricane can come through, and we think it's the biggest catastrophe that we've ever seen. And we're not quite as robust as we would like to think we are. So I think, although I certainly believe nature should be protected in its own right, it may frankly be a more compelling argument, and it's also an accurate one, that we need to take care of nature so that nature will take care of us. Otherwise, we're going to see rapid changes that will cost us a lot economically, socially, cause political unrest, and that's part of the message of the book, that we're tinkering with nature in ways that are dangerous to ourselves.
Your own awakening began as a young person. You're a scientist. You're immersed in the deep history of our Earth, and now we have ever heightened concerns about, are we going to survive? Mm-hmm. Do you find that tempering your work with students?
I think it does. I think when I started teaching, especially as a woman in the sciences, I was always very careful to not show much of myself, maybe, in my teaching. And I've realized as a teacher and also as someone who speaks in public venues quite a bit, that that's probably wrong. As scientists, many of us feel very passionate relationships with the things that we study. As we get to know the natural world better, we develop something almost like love for the things that we study because we know them intimately. And I think it's okay to show that very human side of the sciences. Science is a very human endeavor. Understanding things in depth is, you know, something that humans alone, we think, do in looking at the natural world. So I have slowly become more comfortable with talking about how science has informed my own personal worldview, both in my writing and in my teaching.
Could you talk a bit about what you see as the danger of time blindness?
Well, you know, the fact is time passes. So we need to plan. We need to understand both human time scales and then the natural time scales that are commensurate with human activities. So my call for thinking like a geologist is really not that radical. I'm asking for us to learn to be able to think on decadal, maybe century kinds of timescales. That's the kind of timescale over which we can make government policy. We can have corporations acting on those timescales, and those are the ones that are going to be relevant for climate change that's looming over us.
As I see it, you're calling for a redemocratization, our view or our planning for the future.
That's right. Right now, the future is being left, no one is taking care of future generations. We don't really have that as a priority. And so the default is a future that we're leaving to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, where they're going to be compounding problems in natural systems that will then aggravate underlying tensions in political and economic systems. And that's just irresponsible. Many people who are maybe would identify as political conservatives say we have an obligation not to leave debt to our those who follow us. So I would argue what we're doing to the climate system is leaving a very deep natural debt to coming generations. And that's something we should take seriously. We need to build into our political and economic systems mechanisms and incentives for longer-term thinking rather than short-term rewards, whether they're economic gains or political power. Most of the reward systems reward short-term thinkers.
So where do individual earthlings, how do we move on this?
Yeah, so I think we can take actions at different levels. As individuals, I maybe naively believe that a shift in our perception of who we are and learning more about the natural world, wherever you are, learning the names of plants and mushrooms and soil types, that's you as an individual, every day we can learn better about the natural environment in which we live, and it leads to a humility, I think, and an awareness that there are things that vastly predate us, that we are not in charge of everything. So I think that's a starting point. Obviously, as an educator, I believe in the power of education. So we can fund better science in our schools. I would love to see earth science more represented in our public schools. And as voters and citizens, we can make sure that we're electing officials who have some understanding of natural systems and how human economies interact with those systems. So I think there are many levels at which we can act.
So think and act like a geologist?
I guess so. I'm not very objective, but that's a start anyway.
Marcia Bjornerud is a professor of geology at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Her new book is called Timefulness: How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. She talked about it with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
Finally today, we have time for some poetry. This one from Wisconsin poet DeWitt Clinton.
While I was teaching at UW-Whitewater, I would often be teaching a class called Introduction to Poetry, a freshman English class, and we were reading a poem by T.R. Hummer entitled The Rural Carrier Stops to Kill a 9-Foot Cottonmouth. And he writes, "There are things in this world a man can't look at without wanting to kill." So I'm teaching this poem to my students, And one of the students questions why, the student is Shirley in this poem, why anyone would want to kill, why a mailman would want to kill a snake. So what I'm trying to do is to combine both T.R. Hummer's poem and the experience of teaching his poem in class, as well as remembering a horrifying experience, at least I think it happened, when I was a kid going off to church camp with mother. On the way to church camp, mother meets the devil. Good Lord, that's what she'd say. Or maybe, goodness gracious. With that, she'd slam the brakes. The three of us launched into the front seat while we plowed the skin and spine right off that fat king snake who made the mistake of sunning on the road to Methodist Bible camp. Good Lord, children, she'd say. We'd twist our necks just to see what was left on that bloody road, thinking about it now when Shirley Tipler, sitting in the back row, questions why a poet disguised as a mail carrier shoots a snake not once but twice. I put my foot down hard for Shirley's sake, the black king snake. But mother, good Lord, mother, wanted that imposter better than dead. She wanted hell. I still don't know why she put the old Delta 88 in reverse, a good 1,000 feet churning up the dust on that sweet August morning, headed backward from whence we came, hitting close to 30, scaring the bejesus right out of us, blood all up in our face, screaming, Mama, Mama! Mother afraid this interloper, dead by sundown, might find our campfires, bite the pale legs of God's sweet children. So she hit reverse, teeth clenched, aimed her sights like God's co-pilot ready to gun down an enemy. All of us little kamikazes, unhappy little campers, burning dust and rubber for Satan if he ever got lazy like that in mother's path while she delivered children to God's summer camp. Hold on, she said. Then she took him out, spine, skin, guts. One more time at higher speed, brakes locked across the back, no pistol shot, just a giant 88 ripping across the backside of evil, making sure. Good Lord, mother. Right there, in the classroom, my foot raising dust on the floor, just as the mailman fires two rounds into the cottonmouth on page 113 in Bumgardner's poetry, never until now remembering the spine-ripping power of mother's hydraulic brakes.
Wisconsin poet DeWitt Clinton reading On the Way to Church Camp, Mother Meets the Devil. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, assistant producer Maddie Andre, digital producer Lauren Sigfusson, and intern Zoe Munson.
We get additional reporting from the WUWM news team, including Emily Files this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.